eyes on me. Can shine until tomorrow. Let me
Santa Cruz, California, a university and beach town, one of America's most liberal cities, now has the toughest panhandling ordinance in California. Sitting on downtown sidewalks, using profane language, panhandling while drunk, or lying about how the money will be spent, all illegal.
Now, people are going to use fear and intimidation to try to hassle money out of other people. We're going to say, no, that's not allowed.
A self-proclaimed socialist led the crackdown.
They have some sense of entitlement. I don't know where they get it from, that somehow the city owes them. Give us your parks. Give us some place to stay, like we owe them a place to survive.
At the same time, the city does fund a wide range of services for the homeless. And it's not just Santa Cruz. Cities all over the U.S. are finding themselves fed up. They've run out of patience. Liberal cities like San Francisco, where police break up soup kitchens operated by the homeless activist group Food Not Bombs for operating without a permit.
I was convicted of serving soup at the Civic Center Plaza in front of City Hall and sentenced to 2 months in jail.
Next week, Santa Monica will adopt new laws banning aggressive solicitation.
People are beginning to say, we've got to grab hold of something and claim it and say, you know, this is going to be the way we're going to save our cities. The sad part is this is the absolute wrong way to do it, that we need to support the people in the inner cities, help them get the jobs and housing and health care they need, or the problem's going to get much worse.
Reporter John Robinson went undercover as a panhandler for a newspaper story.
More than one person spit at my feet.
Americans have always been charitable, but there seems to be little of that feeling left for people who, instead of asking for help, demand it.
Not only a problem, for only one reason that present raises a question, who wants a land? The homeless are a problem, for only one reason.
And stay tuned for Bathurst Spears Broadsides coming at you on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM here in Santa Cruz, the July 5th show. And that, of course, was 15, Land, and actually the first of a number of selections from Skidmark Bob's new CD, or old CD, Houseless USA Volume 1, and we are privileged to be able to play that. I found it stuck right here in the studio as I walked in, sitting in front of my nose, so I thought I would clue you in on it. Thanks, Skidmark, for having that available for me, and let's... well, get some audience reaction maybe later in the show to the songs. I know you're all kind of pining for the usual theme song to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. We didn't start the fire, but we're going to try a couple of different things in order to broaden our repertoire here. And along with that, we have some guests with us this morning, as well as a very loud telephone, which I'm going to attempt to turn down. Let's catch the phone call before we catch the guests.
Hi, you're on free radio.
Well, you were on free radio anyway. Let's see if we can do a little maneuvering here.
Star 69.
Yeah, we could call him back, but I think the best thing to do is to let sleeping callers lie, unless, of course, it's after 11, in which case the police get to lie and give you a sleeping van ticket. Here in Santa Cruz, that's the standard rap. For those who are new to Santa Cruz, we have a law that makes it criminal to be a homeless person, that is to say, to engage in the necessary function of sleeping at night between 11 and 8:30 in the morning. And actually, one of our guests is currently houseless. That's Lee. Let me amp up your mic so you can say something, Lee. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing okay.
And you yourself ever gotten a sleeping van ticket or friend who has one recently?
Not in recent history, about 20 years ago. Not much has changed over time here, you know.
Well, would you say the police are mellower than they were 20 years ago and 10 years ago? Are we heading forward here? Are we advancing? Are we just sort of running around in circles? What's the situation?
It's kind of done a cycle over the years. I got here in 1976, and the sheriffs patrolled the woods on a regular basis and issued citations and arrested people. Then it got mellow for a while due to other altercations that the police had and other issues where they didn't get involved with those issues very much if they could help it. And recently it seems to be coming full cycle.
We actually have, of course, had some minor modifications in the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance in 1999 when Councilmember Catherine Birdseed Byers, or some called her Bullshit Byers, instead of ending the sleeping sections of the camping ordinance, as many of us had hoped would happen in the wake of the 1998 election, simply lowered the fine to $54 and made it so that businesses could have two vehicles parking on their lot with permission, and that you could park in a driveway if you had the written permission of both the tenant and the owner, but only for 3 days of any calendar month. Things are still, of course, pretty illegal for most people who sleep outside, and that's 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people in the city, and anywhere between 6,000 and 10,000 in the county. They don't actually have a county sleeping ban that is quite as draconian, but try to sleep by a roadside in the county, and they can charge you with inhabiting or habitating a vehicle, and it can be a similar road to court or road out of town, because that's what these laws are really all about, in my view. What do you think, Lee?
I'd like to add, really, that there's also a lot of pressure in recent years on people that live in non-standard and alternative housing. Mm-hmm. There used to be many converted garages around here and people dwelling beyond the legal limit in housing, and it was tolerated in this area. That toleration's gone as the economic level of the community that has the majority of funds around here. Some of the people in this town nowadays make more money in a year than, let's say, all the Stag Narrow Boys made in their whole lives.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, they are, for those who don't know the Stag Narrow Boys, they are the sons of, I guess, what business were they in?
They were fishermen.
Uh-huh.
They are fishermen, I should say. Some of them still do that for a living, and they don't make $100,000 a year.
Well, let's invite the other guest who's in the studio to join in the merriment here. Bob Woodside, why are you here in the studio? How did you get in here anyway?
Well, you invited me today mostly to report on what I see at the river, I guess.
Camp Paradise?
That's correct.
Yeah, we are going to, of course, be having a long report on Camp Paradise. I want to kind of tease all you folks who are waiting for the Camp Paradise report, because I think we got some other stuff that's important, too, that doesn't have the high-profile publicity of Camp Paradise, but that is important. Any comments, Bob, on stuff that Lee and I have been kind of throwing back and forth around the sleeping ban?
Well, people got to sleep. You just can't say you can't sleep. It's an impossibility in the first place.
Hey, that's what our police say all the time. We've got a phone call here. Hi, you're on free radio.
Hey, me and my friends need this report. We don't want to be sitting around teased by our radio.
Listen, this is
news source.
This is Tease Radio Santa Cruz,
TRFC. Well, we should get that at KSCO if we need that.
I see.
Just a line or two, a sentence, you know, like status report.
Well, all right.
I got three people that are out of range of the radio station waiting for my call based on your show. Bye.
Actually, Robert, can I say something about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Don't take our word for anything. Go out there and see. You know, we can tell you anything. You know, and they can tell you anything. But if you want to know what's going on, go and see.
And, of course, Bob, you're talking about Camp Paradise,
which is correct.
Clean and sober, neat and tidy campground under the, well, along the San Lorenzo River, just past the Highway 1 bridge. You can reach it by going to Denny's Restaurant on Ocean Street, going up Felker Street, which is right next to Denny's, between Denny's and the freeway, actually, going to the end of Felker Street. Right before the end on your right, there's a path that leads up onto the levee, and then you swing down under the bridge, right next to the river, and you keep going up the river until you hit Camp Paradise. And it isn't very far. It's about a 3 or 4 minute walk, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and don't worry about whether you're safe or not, because you're safe over there.
Except it's, yeah, it's
nobody will bother you or anything if you're worried about, you know, what kind of, you know, climate you'd be walking into. All those people are really friendly.
It's actually
people.
Quite a beautiful walk, and the river is nice.
Oh,
it's cool down there today.
Yes, it is.
And if you come at night, and you're welcome to come at night, too, because we're having a meeting there tonight at 8:30. I think it's 8:30 that the meeting is starting. Might be 8. I'm going to show up closer to 8:30 because like my show ends here at 8 o'clock. You just, if you can, have a flashlight with you. Though I think at 8 o'clock we still have some light in the sky since this is sort of the middle of the summer. And bring a flashlight if you can. And if you can't, hang out until somebody else arrives with a flashlight. And then we'll go down with you, because there's a lot of folks who are interested and concerned and actually have been very active today in the fight, and it is now a fight to save Camp Paradise, essentially from the police department, the city manager, the city attorney, and one has to say it, the city council. So let's go into a brief update on this, and then we'll extend it later in the show to keep a little bit of the tantalizing going. Camp Paradise was informed on July 3rd by officers, by their own attorney, a man who was their attorney. I understand they now have discharged him, Paul Sanford, that the city had decided to come in and ticket them, and that they were to take the tickets and not to make any fuss in the media, or they would lose his services. They, in essence, said to him, what about this deal you have sitting in your files? What about this agreement with the city council to give us 2 or 3 weeks where we could negotiate moving to a piece of property which we ourselves would lease? We're not looking for anything free. And this attorney first said you only have till tomorrow to leave. Then he came back after 2 or 3 hours before leaving on vacation for a week and said, oh, you have 2 days apparently, maybe until July 5th today. This, of course, was, to me, I have to say it, a pretty direct betrayal of, not necessarily on the attorney's part, but certainly on the city council's part, and the attorney's leaving at this key time did not strike me as something I was particularly happy with. And I've had this Paul Sanford on the show, and Paul seemed to be very forthcoming. However, apparently, according to Camp Paradise spokesperson Larry Templeton, he was in the habit of drawing Larry off to the side to talk about issues instead of talking about them in front of the whole group of people. And when I rounded up this attorney a week and a half ago, my apologies, folks, there aren't any other attorneys who apparently were interested, but I told him one of my concerns in dealing with groups of people is you'd be a client for the whole, an attorney for the whole group, that you share information with the whole group, and if they want to share information with other people, they can do it, and they can in fact instruct their attorney to do that. If you're going to play attorney games where the attorney controls the whole situation, directs clients not to talk when the clients themselves are actually engaged in a political struggle here, and that's what it is. It's not just a legal struggle, since the legal situation is very tenuous. There is a camping ban. These folks are illegal out there because of this medieval law passed in 1978 at the onus of the police department, at the inspiration of the police department in the fall of 1978, anti-hippie law. So they're illegal, because they're trying to engage in survival camping. They have no choice. 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people like them have no choice. In fact, some of them have been referred by the city's own Emergency Interface Satellite Shelter Service, and there's documentation to that effect. Does that affect our city council? Will they come out with a statement? Will they take the actions that their own Homeless Issues Task Force have urged them to do, namely to suspend the camping ban? at least to suspend the sleeping sections of the camping ban, although you need tents too for privacy and dignity. You need to be able to cook food to be able to survive in a healthy way. No, the city council has refused to even put any of these items on the agenda in spite of specific campaign promises to the electorate to do this. Tim Fitzmaurice, Christopher Crone, that's our mayor and vice mayor, Ed Porter, Emily Riley, Keith Sugar, shame. Shame. And it's up to this community to bring this issue to the city council, and more important, to bring it past the city council so that we don't spend our times begging, pleading, coaxing the city council, but we do the kind of organizing in the community that simply tells the council, we've had enough of this. Whether it means a recall, whether it means initiatives, whether it just means setting up a campground and having setting up a perimeter so that people can sleep while the council decides whether it has enough courage to let them do what they got to do anyway. This is what has to be done in this community, in my view. And this is what Camp Paradise has done. Camp Paradise originally wasn't making a big deal of itself. It didn't go into a situation where it announced, we're Camp Paradise, look at us. The police came down after Mayor Fitzmaurice came down and said, you've got a nice campground here. We'll try and get you a porta potty. Actually, it was a dumpster, and we'll also try to get you porta potties. And then not another word from Fitzmaurice, but the police arrived soon after and told them, you have until July 1st to vacate. Then they went to the media. Then they started organizing and called in the activists. And then when Paul Sanford, the attorney, came along and said, look, keep a low profile. I'll talk to these city council members. I'm an attorney. See, here's my bar card. They'll listen to me. What happened was these campers, eager to be, they're not activists. They're not troublemakers. They're not followers of these evil Norsian types like myself. No. These are people who just want to be able to live. And they trusted this man. They trusted what he told them were the city council promises. And on July 3rd, the city council, according to Paul Sanford, or it's actually through the city manager and the city attorney, but it was the police, and so the city council was doing nothing about it, said, get the hell out of here. We're going to tear down your tents. We're going to destroy your property. We have no place for you to go. And that's just tough luck. So there was, of course, an emergency. An activist came in and said, well, do you see what we were saying to you now? That this council is not worth a damn. It's not worth three pieces of spit unless you get something in writing and you have an attorney to enforce it and you have a large group of people in the community who are willing to back you. And the campers, in essence, said, yeah. because of anything the campers had done. They had tried the best of their ability to go along with not just the legal process, because you can't, in this county, you can't be legal and homeless. So the only option is to remove themselves from this county. But then what about the next county and the next and the next? It's not just here. It's everywhere. It's this hideout or get out syndrome that is everywhere in this country. So you can't. You have to make a stand somewhere. People live here. People have connections here. People have jobs here. People have the right to be here. It's all, I'm telling people things I think that they already know. So on July 3rd, they were told that by Sanford they have to leave. They say no. On July 4th, Officer Seeley and Officer Perry, I understand I wasn't present, came in and told Larry Templeton, you are going to have to go. We'll be back on July 5th to give you tickets. And then on the day after that, we will come in and we will arrest you and destroy the campground. So a lot of us began kind of pouring into the camp, meeting, talking, offering to help, helping to move some of their irreplaceable stuff out of the camp, but they don't want to move. They are not prepared. They had decided they were going to make a stand there. There was no point in moving to another place where the police would pick them off one by one individually. There was no point in trying to hide in the forests from the authorities when the authorities are showing that they don't, that they're asking them to disperse the strongest positive, productive camping area that has actually been created in Santa Cruz that I've heard of in my experience here. And they decided to make a stand. So today they did. And Lee is giving me a note here. Lee, why don't you comment yourself on what your thoughts are on this? You have some thoughts, I'm sure.
Yes. While the table was downtown and they were doing some leafleting and canvassing, a labor-ready worker apparently walked up to one of the people at the table and showed him a work order for tomorrow regarding cleaning up trash down by the San Lorenzo River. The general suspicion is that they're going to attempt to use labor-ready employees to tear down this camp if they're ticketed and removed, which would be a rather interesting scenario, considering some of those labor-ready workers may camp there. I don't know if labor-ready is aware of the situation. Other people are supposed to get involved in checking in, but I thought that would be an interesting point to make as well.
Oh, I think it is, and actually it ties in interestingly with something else that we learned. We had a meeting, a fairly large meeting of the Homeless Working Group, which is a group that has to be distinguished from the Green Party's Homeless Shirking Group, which is spending its time attacking activists and defending Green Party turncoat Tim Fitzmaurice, who's betraying the very sleeping band platform that the Green Party says is a part of its basic principled platform. Not the Green Party Shirking Group, but the Homeless Working Group met out at the campground today around 9 o'clock. And this group meets usually every Thursday at Baker Square from 9 to 11. It's just begun to meet again. It actually did a lot of meeting last year to try to save the safe zones, to try to set up parking lot areas for homeless vehicles to park in and so forth. It began meeting in the Chamber of Commerce under the auspices of Michael Schmidt, myself, activist Becky Johnson, and others. And it was quite successful in interviewing all the candidates, or most of the candidates who ran for city council, and getting them on tape on homeless issues so that they could lie their heads off, and then they would get to hear their own lies a year later. And I say lie their heads off. What that means is make promises. Perhaps they were sincere at that particular moment on the promises, but of course, we've seen there's been absolutely no action on any homeless issue other than capital improvements for the Homeless Services Center. In terms of, I guess they passed the kitchen like 6 months ago. This huge overpriced kitchen got put into the Homeless Services Center, and there's been a few social service actions, but nothing to deal with the basic shelter crisis. Not one addition to the shelter, not one bed has been added to the shelter. There is true that one church was added for the summer, so instead of, I think, what is it, 18 or 19 spaces, you have 39 spaces per night, but it's always full, and that's 1,000 to 2,000 people. But no campground created, no lifting of the criminalization of homeless people, as every major organization in town has called for, with the absence, with the omission of the police department, Green Party, the SCAN, Santa Cruz Action Network, CalPERG, the Community Action Board, the Homeless Issues Task Force, you name it. Everybody has said, certainly don't suspend the sleeping portions of the camping ordinance. You can't have sleeping a crime, and set up campgrounds and safe and legal places to sleep. There really was no real dispute on this issue from certainly at least two of the candidates, Emily Riley and Ed Porter, although Riley has been backpedaling furiously and with a big smile on her face talking about all the wonderful things that are being done by the city council. It's sad to see a woman who had previously been involved in fighting for homeless causes twist so markedly to the right. Anyway, getting lost in my own rhetoric here, what happened today was that this large meeting that was held at the campground today, people decided to invest in a cellular phone for the campground. They decided to go out and flyer, and there's been a table downtown all day with looks like 2 to 4 people doing it. Particular plaudits to Jim Costner for his initiative, his enthusiasm, his leadership in this case. He's been doing a lot of work around that, and he was sleeping at the campground last night, as was I. There's been a call by Camp Paradise for folks to come and sleep there, because the more people who are there and as bodies present, the less chance there is that the police will follow apparently the orders of City Manager for Life Dick Wilson and City Attorney Forever John Barisoni, and Police Chief, you knew him during Code Blue, he's still with us, Steve Belcher. Code Blue was the Beat Up the Homeless plan that was in the late 70s and early 80s here in Santa Cruz. Belcher was in there. He wasn't police chief then, but he was on the force. And now he's the police chief and has been since 1993, 94. Anyway, the more people at Camp Paradise, the less chance there is that the police will want to risk a huge, messy media broadcast arrest situation against campers that are simply trying to live. Although more and more, these campers, I think, are becoming convinced that their fate is to some extent tied to the fate of the homeless community generally, that they could cut a special deal with the city. If they just keep their mouths shut and don't raise these issues loudly, then, Emperor Tim Fitzmaurice will find them a special piece of royal property somewhere off in the boonies. you know, throw them a bone, get them out of sight, and the rest of the homeless population can just continue hiding or getting ticketed or getting driven out of town as usual. But I don't think these campers are going to do that. I think these campers have decided they have seen the power of saying no to unjust laws, just as Gandhi saw it, just as Martin Luther King saw it, and I think just as a lot of Santa Cruzans are seeing it now. You know, I mean, I don't know. We've had this fight going for 20 years, and it's, you know, it's still going. We don't have any victory, you know, immediately in sight. It sort of pops up. People start getting excited about it, and then the city council throws them a bone and says, oh, well, you know, here, we'll give you a couple extra shelter spaces in the winter. Now go home and shut up. Or Keith Sugar announces, we'll have safe sleeping zones, and then a month later pulls them off the agenda at 1 a.m. at night, or I should say votes them down. Actually, Sugar didn't vote him down. It was Byers who did, but Sugar was culpable in that whole thing for not bringing them up at the appropriate time, not doing the necessary publicity for them, not advocating for them in a public way. So he helped kill the safe sleeping zones just as surely as Byers did, in my view. So we in the community need to take these actions. The city council is not going to put rent control on the agenda, folks. It's the city. It's the community that needs to put rent control on the agenda. The city is not going to tell the police to stop harassing people downtown and differentially enforcing laws and selectively enforcing codes and going after homeless people. It's the community that has to walk up and say, excuse me, officer, what is going on here? And then call other people over. Here is harassment happening, folks. Let's have a look at it. Let's see what's going on here. Officer, what law are you enforcing? Against who? And what's going on? It's the eyes, ears, and the voices in the community that will take action, not Christopher Crone, not Tim Fitzmaurice, not Ed Porter. No, none of these people have shown any backbone whatsoever. The marimba players had to come in massive force to the city council to get any kind of hearing from Christopher Crone in a public way. And they are kind of the upper middle class of the musicians. The police have been harassing the rest of the musicians as they wish on the mall. And there's been no action from Crone against the downtown ordinances that are used to harass people who are beggars. Yes, they are beggars. They're people who need to ask for spare change. And that's not always the most pleasant thing for me to have as I walk down the street. There's some people who codge me for coffee that I get rather annoyed with. But do I want to put them into jail for doing that? No, that's Neil Coonerty and Scott Kennedy who want to do that. Those are the individuals who passed the downtown ordinances. And who keep it in place? Porter, Riley, Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar. That's our city council, folks. And, of course, city manager for life, Dick Wilson. This is the guy who has been in power since the early 80s, gets a six-figure salary, and runs the entire show. And the city council gets made idiots of periodically, actually regularly, because this guy is the guy who is the real power. And this city council won't even consider raising the issue of firing his ass and getting him replaced by somebody who actually is, you know, concerned about the Tidelands, is not going to give them away to the Seaside Company, who wants real affordable housing and not just a sellout to the Mercy Charities Housing's little pet projects that will use up 5 years of affordable housing. These old-time bureaucrats run the system in Santa Cruz, no matter who gets elected, because the people who are elected don't have the guts to stand up and mobilize the public against them. Christopher Crone is waiting for a wave of publicity, a wave of leadership from the streets, before he'll even utter those forbidden words, rent control. Well, folks, we're the ones who've got to utter them. We've got a call coming in here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Scott, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Have you been listening to the show?
A little bit.
Good. Well, what's your thought? I guess you were a sometime council watcher before you got so disgusted you took off.
Yeah. Well, I still watch them, but they don't say much to them because they don't listen anyway.
Right.
But, you know, I used to talk a lot. It all was for naught, pretty much. But,
street corner.
One of the things that you said was incorrect.
Oh, please correct.
When you were talking about using up 5 years of the housing fund for this Mercy project, it's going to use up 17 years.
I should have said at least 5 years, yeah.
It's going to use up at least 17 years, probably many more. The other day at the rally downtown, you were talking about Dick Wilson and John Barisoni. You said they both had six-figure incomes. Barisoni's is a seven-figure. Yeah, the city attorney's office, I mean, it doesn't all go to him, but it goes to his law firm, over $1 million a year.
I wasn't there for Barisoni's the renewal of his contract. I'd either been expelled from the city council chambers for three sessions running. They have evicted me using a police officer, and in essence arrested and removed me in a non-custodial arrest. So I haven't been following all of it. It may have been one of those sessions I didn't get to, but I have not seen any meaningful review of the city attorney, even though this is the city attorney that's giving away the Tidelands. Well, can you tell us a little bit about your opinion of the city attorney, John Barisoni, and his history in helping the Santa Cruz community?
Well, basically, I don't think he's ever won a case for the city. I'm not really in. A lot of times he gives opinions to the city council, which other attorneys disagree with. And, they take his opinion as being law. I mean, it was like just recently they appointed Gene Arner as the head of planning for the planning department, or Dick Wilson did. And a number of the council people actually asked Dick Wilson not to do that. And Wilson went to Barisoni, got Barisoni to send them letters saying that they were going beyond their charge as council members, that it was his role as the city manager to hire these department heads, not their role. And they could actually be brought up on charges if they continued to harass him about this appointment. And supposedly Celia Scott and Claudia Schaefer, both attorneys, disagree with Barisoni's assessment here, that it is within the city council's purview to actually either decide who is going to take a leadership role in a department, or say we don't want this person to take this lead role in a certain department.
Well, certainly, Scott, the council could, by four votes, and this was what I found out from city clerk Leslie Cook, dump the city manager and or the city attorney and or the police chief, and they could replace that person, or they could let that person know that they would be fired unless they engaged in behavior that was more in keeping with the policies of the city council. That's my understanding.
Right. I mean, every year the city council has a review of all of these top jobs, the city clerk, and the city attorney, the city manager, all of the department heads. They review all their performances and decide whether or not to keep them for another year. But this is all done in closed session. And basically, they're is no information given to the public. It's considered a personnel matter, so it's all private. We don't even get to know whether or not they've approved the person. It's just the fact that they're still there that we know that that person was approved for another year.
Well, it is true that the city attorney's legal contract, which is a hefty, as you pointed out, a hefty sum, is on the agenda, the open agenda of city council, and it can be addressed by the public. In theory, a member of the city council could ask this go to subcommittee for hearings. Could they not?
They could, but that's never happened.
But what about Christopher Crone, the fair-haired boy who was going to lead us all to a meaningful people's resolution of the Tidelands, which has got an interesting coverage in this week's Metro for those who haven't seen it, but seems now to essentially be going along with the old Rotkin-Kennedy agenda. What's your sense on that?
Well, these people are deciding that, let's negotiate with the Seaside Company. They've been negotiating with the Seaside Company now for a year and a half. Those negotiations have gotten absolutely nowhere. The Seaside Company still insists that it's their land, and they're not giving it up. They want to, basically, they'll give the city 15% of that parking lot. That's the same deal that was struck before these guys got elected. The deal that they turned down, and once they got into office, they got rid of that deal and turned it down and then hired this hotshot attorney from San Francisco, and that won the Mona Lake case, and you know they've given that guy quite a bit of money. I think over $70,000.
Well, I read in the article that there was a report that the city is not, we have not yet been able to see, but I guess it's coming out on the 7th or the 8th in some slideshow. But I mean, I guess I want to get back.
There's still no report from this attorney, Tony Rossman. I mean, all they're going to do is they're going to go over stuff that's already in the public view. They're not going over any of this closed session stuff. We're not going to get anything from any of, you know, that's all. John Barisoni, I mean, I don't understand why they don't ask for a second opinion on this stuff. John Barisoni said that they can't release any information that Tony Rossman has dug up. None of it.
You know, it's an interesting contrast, Scott. If you can compare our city attorney with the Santa Monica city attorney in the 80s, the Santa Monica city attorney was a man who refused to draw up a law that would criminalize homeless poor people for eating food in the parks. And he also drew up a sleeping law that replaced the sleeping ban down there and allowed actually homeless people to sleep in kind of rotating way in Santa Monica during the 80s. He actually, they had a law down there about he couldn't be discharged without a 5-7 vote. We don't have that here, by the way, as far as I understand it. But he was able to successfully stand off the city council. So I think it is possible for a city attorney, Bob Myers was his name, to take a courageous stand on issues. And indeed, there's a public defender in Santa Barbara, Glenn Maurer, who is now, he's resigned as public defender and is now taking cases, every single camping and sleeping case that comes along, as we'll hear in an interview later in the show, is actually being not only fought in court but appealed if the judge finds against the homeless person. So you don't have to be an asshole, or let's put it this way, I don't want to put it that way, simply a conservative corporate spokesperson, a spokesperson of a conservative bureaucratic or corporate seaside company type agenda to be a city attorney or even a city manager, don't you think?
Right. I mean, that's the problem we have here in Santa Cruz is, although we've had so-called progressive city council members, we've never had a progressive city attorney. We've never had a progressive city manager.
Well, I don't think
we've never had a progressive chief of police.
Well, I don't think they're progressive city council members unless they, you know, take at least some kind of token action to replace officials who are clearly engaging in repressive policies.
Well, that's why they so-called progressive.
Right, of course. Well, Scott, let me. Are you going to think you're going to be with our show for a while, or are you kind of zipping in and out?
I'm going to be listening for a while.
Because what I'd like to do is continue with the Camp Paradise report, maybe get some thoughts from Lee and Bob here in the studio, and then perhaps you might want to call in again if I'm sure there are other areas. There's a big council meeting coming up on Tuesday. The Board of Supervisors meeting is coming up, and I think the Camp Paradise issue may figure in those meetings. Camp Paradise people may be at those meetings en masse as well as their supporters.
Well, I think that's another thing that we could do as far as Camp Paradise goes. I mean, we've had a number of the council people that have come down to visit Camp Paradise in person. Well, now let's take those same council members on a tour of the other side of the river. Let's show them what's really going on the other side of the river.
They
let
know.
Them decide which side of the river looks better, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and of course what you're pointing out is that there's massive heroin dealing camps that have been set up that are over there that, you know, that are not being disturbed. And I you know, I'm, since I do a lot of talking about the absurdity of the drug war, I'm not, you know, as big a fan of harassing homeless people for drug use and sales.
Well, I don't think we should harass them, but I mean, I think that these council members should get a first-hand look at what's going on over there, so that they have something to compare Camp Paradise to. I mean, it's just across the river.
That's true. We could, you know, we could have a long boat and kind of ferry them across, or maybe catapult them. I think possibly, you know,
shoot them out of cannon.
Shoot them out of a cannon. I think, you know, that certainly make a big bang, and the usual smoke and mirrors would be missing. But you know, there you have it. You have the smoke without the mirrors.
But they would probably be afraid to go down there without a police escort, which, you know, would mean that there would just be people scurrying through the woods, and that's about all they'd see, except all the trash that was left behind.
Yeah, I noticed that the council members have not come to Camp Paradise. Crone was down there I think at the, yesterday on the July 4th, at the edge of the trail leading down to Paradise, but he didn't get down to the camp itself. In fact, he carried some water down to under the bridge area and then scurried away. There's some who claim that he was seen urinating under the bridge, but I regard that as apocryphal because I know Christopher Crone, who asked that bathrooms and porta potties and actually voted for them and got the city council to vote for them in February of 1999, would never do such a thing, even though he has, for some inexplicable reason, not gotten those porta potties or dumpsters into the camping areas as his task force to set up bathrooms is supposed to have done. Inexplicably, and I guess the city manager may have something to do with that, you know. Anyway, thank you, Scott. Call back?
I'll try.
All right.
Well, it looks like dead air. I was trying to put a little music there. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is the July 5th show here, 2001. Into the millennium, we have in the studio with us Lee and Uncle Bob, as well as your very own Uncle Robert here. Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3. Phone number, want to call in and join us, 427-3772. Again, after having teased everybody for half an hour as to what's happening, the latest word, a delegation, Larry, and Larry, an individual from Friends Outside, and a Green Party member went down to talk to Tim Fitzmaurice and and Chief Belcher, not because they were asked to, but just as a kind of a proactive gesture or action on the part of the Camp Paradise community to say, look, this is what we're doing. This is what we want. What are you doing? I don't understand why you're sending in police in violation of the agreements we thought we had. Well, according to what I understand what happened, and I'm hopeful that Larry Templeton or someone else who was present will call in and give a direct account of what our very own Emperor Tim, or Fuhrer Tim, as I like to call him, said. That's Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, for those of us who are concerned with the forms of courtesy. I've quite had it with courtesy for Tim Fitzmaurice, given the way he has treated homeless people and just ordinary members of the public at City Council. I think he needs to be characterized as he is, in fact, acting, and not in any exaggerated, respectful fashion. So that's why I call repression repression. I call a Fuhrer, and I call an emperor. I call someone who represses people at City Council repressive. That's what I do. And if Tim wants to eject me for that, well, then he will, and he has, no doubt he will again. We'll see if the courts uphold that, if anybody ever has the resources to take it to court. Anyway, at the meeting with Fitzmaurice, apparently Fitzmaurice, when asked how many complaints, he said he originally came down to see the camp, not because, he heard it was such a wonderful camp, but because he had heard there were complaints about the camp, and he wanted to come down. When he was asked by Larry Templeton how many complaints, he did his usual, I don't have to tell you how many complaints. It doesn't matter how many complaints. He didn't give an answer, in other words. But he talked about one particular complaint, which Larry explained, and it was a complaint that had to do with a disruptive couple that was, you know, not following the camp rules. If you come to Camp Paradise, you see a sign that talks about the camp rules: no drugs, no drinking. You got to be clean. You can't crap outside your tent. You have to go up to the use facilities, whether there's a porta potty there, if there is one. There was one there for a short time before reportedly the city pressured the porta potty company into removing it from city property. It's a similar thing that they did when homeless protests were at City Hall. They closed the bathrooms and then they blamed homeless people for pissing in the bushes. It's classic Rotkin. It was amazing. And the Sentinel, of course, played up the feces and the piss in 1996 at City Hall. Similarly here in 2001, they're doing the same thing. Anyway, there was a meeting with Fitzmaurice, and Fitzmaurice then apparently told them that he had had nothing to do with the announcement they were going to come down and arrest people, that this was a misunderstanding or some rogue initiative by the police department. These aren't his words. These are my impression of what was said secondhand, and that they were happy to proceed, but what they wanted to do was lower the temperature, have less media, have less, high-profile debate about the camp, and let's just, hush-hush, stay low, and let's go ahead and try to continue the negotiations. And I guess the meeting tonight at the campground will be about what strategy to pursue around this issue. I, of course, believe that anything Fitzmaurice says is largely worthless unless it's backed up by some either legal document or press release. He has to make a public statement. For him to make a statement in private to me doesn't essentially mean anything. I don't see that that is as holding much water, because so far we've seen the campers, the police department is a rogue police department. They do what they want under the city manager, who can do what he wants because the city council won't rein him in either. So I think it's a situation where it's not that Fitzmaurice is a perennial liar. I'm not saying that, although I think his violation of the Green Party platform and his campaign promises around the sleeping ban shows him to be less than a forthright and committed to what he said, and then maybe that's a little different than being a liar. By the way, Fitzmaurice has always been invited to call in on this show and discuss what I regard as his failings, and he is entitled to have his time on the air. And if he wants to, he can do so now, as can any other city council member. If they have deal with, and they're trying now to do the same thing with people like Michael Schmidt, who's running against their fearless leader Marty Wormhout, the supervisor whose homeless record is utterly horrible. Anyway, so the general update for the Camp Paradise is, according to Mayor Fitzmaurice, via the delegation that went to him today, there is now some more time for Camp Paradise. My response to that, of course, is that is not necessarily worth the breath it's uttered with unless it's backed up by something. And maybe Tim Fitzmaurice is speaking earnestly. Maybe he will actually take the actions that rein in the police. And I understand he called the police from the office, and Deputy Chief Locke reassured Larry Templeton that Officer Seeley was not there appropriately, or that somehow that was a misunderstanding, and that was some personal problem, perhaps, between Larry and Eric, the police officer. That, by the way, Eric is the only thing that came out of the Homeless Issues Task Force: more cops for the homeless. Thank you very much. Without any training, mind you, in terms of how to deal with homeless people from the homeless community. So I don't know what to say, except that this whole subject will be discussed tonight at 8:30. There may well be at least a brief hiatus in police harassment, because it would be rather embarrassing for the mayor. Although the mayor can always deny it. Oh, he misunderstood what I said. Or, oh no, we found, some urine on the trail, so we're going to move in anyway. It's a health hazard. They can say what they want and then do what they want, unless the community stands up and says, no, there is a housing emergency in Santa Cruz. Affordable housing in Santa Cruz is a vehicle. Here's a group of people who have created a safe camp, who created an area that their neighbors are proud of. We're not going to let you destroy this without a major stink that will force you to really explain yourselves in a fashion that may be very embarrassing for you. And so I think Camp Paradise at the moment, and I'm not speaking for them because I'm not a resident of Camp Paradise. They were gracious enough to let me stay as a guest last night, and I believe they're still inviting people to come down and stand with them, because it's not clear what the city council is doing, and perhaps we'll get a call from someone in Camp Paradise giving us more specific details on this. But I say go down to Camp Paradise, as Bob here has said, see for yourself and offer to help them. They need funds, they need legal support, they need material support, they need storage space, because when the police decide to move and destroy the structures there, and there aren't any permanent structures, there's some temporary structures that are very nice and very, I think, they're easy on the eye, and they're useful, and they've actually turned it into a, how would you put it, it's sort of a, it's an easily accessible area. It's an area that's more comfortable than it was. It's an area that's user-friendly. And it's an area that I think the people there take pride in maintaining. Bob, I've been babbling a lot. Any comments from you? You've been down there the last couple days.
The way that it looks is almost like a county park down there. They got it so cleaned up, It looks like somebody was paid to do it. The only way to actually decide whether you think this is a good thing down there or a bad thing, you're going to have people that have already made their minds up one way or the other. The people that think this is a bad thing without any proof or without checking for themselves, I'm sorry for you, we love you anyway, but if you're not decided or you don't know what you think about this, or if you do know what you think about this and you're pro for these people, then, you know, you need to make yourself present down there and see for yourself, you know, so people can't lie to you if you see it with your own eyes.
Well, another thing you can do is you can call in at 420-5017. That's the city council hotline, or though it's been pretty cold for years as far as I'm concerned, but it is a 24-hour message line, 420-5017, and tell them, one, end the sleeping ban, because this is Camp Paradise. We need to protect Camp Paradise, but we also need to recognize that that's only a small percentage of the homeless people. But yes, save Camp Paradise and stop the sleeping ban. This is the message that should go out to Fitzmaurice and his council and his manager for life, Dick Wilson, and his highly paid city attorney, John Barisoni, and his apparently clueless police chief, Steve Belcher. It should go out every day, every hour to these people until they really lay off.
Robert, what's the current estimate of homeless people in Santa Cruz?
Santa Cruz City homeless, I estimate at 1,000 to 2,000. I think that even that's a figure being used by other people. There was, I think, 1,250 counted in one night in March of last year by one of the census groups, and so it's considerably more than that, but it's somewhere in that area.
Oh, okay. Then how many people do you suppose live in alternative and non-standard housing in Santa Cruz? Maybe the whole county. I don't know if they've ever done numbers on that. You
very
know, garages
question.
And yeah. RVs in people's backyards and such things. I would estimate, as a rough guess, totally uneducated, maybe 10% of the population of Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. At least.
If 10% of that 10% called the city council, because their butts on the line, too. First they came for the gypsies and Jews, you know.
That's right. That's right. It's actually, I happen to have that quote here in my wallet, a little sticker which I will donate to the studio. I just happen to have it with me here. And the quote is this: first they came for the communists and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for me and there was no one left to speak out for me. Pastor Martin Niemöller, Nazi concentration camp survivor, and it's a good quote.
And indeed, it's probably part of the same agenda to eliminate most of the alternative housing in Santa Cruz City, if not the county. It'd be harder to do in the county because there's a large migrant population in South County, but up here, it's money. And at one time, there was talk of no growth or slow growth in Santa Cruz. When I came here 25 years ago, I took that uneducatedly as meaning that perhaps the locals just wanted to entrench themselves. But apparently something else has happened here. There hasn't been slow growth here or no growth at all. It's just been growth for people that have the money to grow here. And where the service workers might live, Watsonville until recently, but just in case anybody doesn't notice, from Watsonville, you can go to Salinas. The pay is better there. There's more jobs there. Where's Santa Cruz going to get its service workers, the people that make your coffee for you?
Well, perhaps they'll have a guest worker program from the Ivory Coast. I understand that there's some good chocolate workers among the youth. They call it slavery, but hey, these radicals are always exaggerating. Anyway, yeah, very good questions, Lee. And I actually, I'd like to turn now, by the way, if anyone has more questions about Camp Paradise, you can certainly call in and to ask them here for the three of us. We hope that we can get an actual Camp Paradise resident to call in at some point and give us their update. You can come to the meeting tonight at 8:30 out at Camp Paradise.
Please
again.
Come.
Sorry?
Please come.
Yeah, please come to the meeting. You can, again, you can call the Huff line. That's the line for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the organization that I work with that's concerned more broadly with civil rights for homeless people and particularly concerned with Camp Paradise at this key point at 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-4833. You'll get a message phone, but just leave a message and I'll try to get back to you or some other Huffster will, some Huffy individual. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. It's Robert, Lee, and Bob here in the studio kind of talking about Camp Paradise and the city's latest flip-flop on Camp Paradise. Now they're saying, oh, you misunderstood. We're not going to remove Camp Paradise yet. We just want to, you know, cool things off and keep it out of the front pages. So And tell all your supporters to go home and trust us. You know, thank you very much. I actually don't think the campers are going to believe that one again. You know, I mean, there are lots of bridges in different parts of the country you can buy, but I think that one's been sold a little too many times. We'll see what happens. I mean, it's certainly true that there's nothing wrong with open negotiations with the city council. There's nothing wrong with open negotiations with the city manager and the city attorney, but they should be open. It should be not one individual attorney who meets behind closed doors and then gives us reassurances that we don't know what they are, says he has papers in his office. I was told by Larry Templeton yesterday that he was actually instructed by attorney Paul Sanford to tell the community of homeless people that Sanford was supposedly representing that he, Larry Templeton, had seen the documents that were the city council had signed and the city manager had signed to reassure the homeless community there that all was well, when in fact no such documents existed. Now, you know, I mean, my point is not to impugn Paul Sanford, not to impugn Larry Templeton, none of these people. I think Paul has good intentions. I know Larry has good intentions. I mean, I think we all have good intentions. I might even say Tim Fitzmaurice has good intentions. But it depends on the process you use, whether and how much power you have and how you're using it in the circumstances you're in. I mean, for people to know what's going on, they have to have the information. Attorneys delight in these backroom, closed-door negotiations, which, to me, not only sell people's rights down the river every day at the courthouse. Public defenders do this, or public pretenders, as I call them, as they make their deals with the prosecutors in this obscene drug war stuff that's going on as an incredible racket every day as we speak. But you also have it happening, you know, in the situation where a intentioned attorney, Paul Sanford, wants to only negotiate with one person at the camp instead of doing what campers and I had requested he do beforehand, which was talk to the group and talk openly to the group so they can be discussion of what's going on. And I hope that any new attorney that is hired by Camp Paradise or volunteers will do that. And I know attorneys are used to being able to kind of be the experts, control their clients, all this sort of thing. Well, they have to realize that instead they are the servants in this situation of the they are the people who are working for the individuals whose rights are being challenged, whose very survival is being questioned. And some people may poo-poo this, but I don't think that's true.
And it is possible to do, because I believe in the late 70s or early 80s, there was a situation at Scott's Creek, north of Santa Cruz,
Scott Creek Bluff, yeah.
Where there were a bunch of people camping in vehicles and buses, mostly artist, musician types. Some of them went on to form a rather famous troupe of performers that I won't name here. But
Tom Noddy was one of them.
Yes, Tom, and he's in town too. He'd be interesting to get on a show like this.
Maybe we should call him.
But don't do it on my say so. But anyway, there was a local lawyer who did deal with the whole case, and when he went to these people to discuss it, he did do it on a community basis. The lawyer is not required to just single out one person that's the leader of a group. They can discuss it with the whole group. When I was an anti-war activist in the 60s, the lawyers that handled a lot of my anti-war demonstration cases would take on, you know, 10 or 15 people standing in front of a judge, and it wouldn't be a problem. And a lawyer can choose to represent a whole group and deal with them as a group, you know, decision by committee. Lawyers, there's no reason why they can't do that. I think Robert has Tom Noddy on the phone, and maybe we'll get some more insight into the Scott's Creek incident that happened in the late 70s, early 80s. Eventually, I believe that case got thrown out of court because the officers, and they were sheriffs undoubtedly, climbed on the vehicles to gain access to seeing. Oh, here's Tom.
Actually, we have on the air with us Traveling Tom Noddy, as I call him. Tom is the bubble man about Santa Cruz. Hey, Tom.
Hello, Robert.
And Tom, we're looking into the Camp Paradise situation, which of course you're not familiar with because you've been out of town, but you are, I think, probably quite familiar with what happened at Scott Creek Bluff when you were all arrested, your vans hauled away. You, because your homes have been stolen, you went to the county building and made that your home for a while, were arrested there, And then you took on attorney, or I guess he took you on, attorney Ray Grunike, now Ray Glock Grunike, who actually, there were 15 or 20 of you?
Wow, Robert, you know the whole tale. The tale is told. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye, folks. Wait, go back to the question part.
Okay, I'm sorry.
How many of us were there? Yeah, initially, out at Scott Creek itself, on the day of the that the police came out and took away the vans, they arrested 11 people, took away 9 vans and buses, and as you said, we were out on our own recognizance after that, and decided to go live in the county building until the county would give us our homes back. And then they came on December the 23rd while we were there and arrested people. By then, what had started as 9 people inflated to 23. 23 people were arrested on that night.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you formed a defense committee and a defense group involving Ray Glock Grunike, who actually would hold mass meetings with all of you, right?
Yeah, that's right. Ray entered our group. Actually, I'd been talking to Ray for quite a while before that arrest at the county building, and he was too broke, he really couldn't do it, then he was there with us, just visiting with us when the sheriffs came down, and we suddenly sat in a circle, negotiated, and he told us, you need a lawyer, and he became our lawyer at that moment as the police closed in.
Kind of put him on the spot, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I know then that you had you spent 6 months defending yourselves, and you had the most remarkable jury nullification result, where you in essence admitted the crimes of, in essence, what, living in vehicles or trespass or whatever it was, and the jury just said, we don't care, not guilty, right?
Well, you know, that was our ideal. And as a bottom line, on a couple of charges, it had to be that, because there really were no extenuating circumstances. In a number of the cases, the jury, I mean, it was the longest jury deliberations in municipal court history in Santa Cruz, because they were looking for ways to acquit us within the law, and it took them a long time. They just wanted to do it because of some good legal reason. It wasn't easy for them, but they found in some cases, you know, they had questions about whether the vehicle wasn't too big to actually meet the definitions of a mobile home recreational vehicle and/or a travel trailer, as the statute said. And in another situation, I mean, they did end up looking for ways to acquit. They really wanted to acquit us. But, as you said, there were situations. I mean, I got on the stand and swore that I did, and then I quoted the statute, park or use my mobile home recreational vehicle and or travel trailer on any parcel of land in Santa Cruz County. I did do that. I plead not guilty to the charge. And I was not convicted.
Yeah, I think that they were saying that the law was wrong and that you guys were doing what you had to do.
I think in that case they had to be saying that or nothing else.
And you then actually did a historic deal with the prosecutor, did you not?
I don't know if it was historic. It was fun. Yeah, actually, we had a big fight about it because, there were two big trials. And one of them was for the people who were arrested out at Scott Creek on December the 20th. This is 1977, by the way. December the 20th, and that was, as I said, 11 people, 9 vehicles. And those people went through a very long trial, the longest in municipal court history in Santa Cruz, and then a very long jury deliberations. And when it was all over, essentially the prosecutor was not anxious to go on and prosecute the second trial because the jury found us not guilty, even though we admitted doing it. They weren't really anxious to have another trial.
And the second trial would have been even bigger, right?
It, 23 people, and all of us just for was essentially trespass in the county building, trespass in a public place.
Because you needed your homes back. They were refusing to give them to you, and so you decided to make the county your home.
Until the county building government would return them.
Right.
And so then on December the 23rd, when they took us away, they had that trespassing in a public place charge. But as you said, it was 6 months later that we actually went to court on the other charge, which then was this long trial. And then the prosecutor really didn't want to do the second one. She offered a deal called DA probation. If we agree not to sit in anywhere else, it's what they regard as essentially a sit-in. Said, no, we're just living here. But anyway, if we we agree not to sit in anywhere else in Santa Cruz County for the next 6 months, then they'll drop all the charges. We dismissed that thought. Drop charges. Why were we in the county building? Because you said that we were trespassing out at Scott Creek, and the jury said we weren't. Why did you take away our homes? The jury said we weren't. Let's have another trial. Let's do it, you know. But in truth, I have to say, a number of the people in the group were not anxious to hang around in town through the summer, have another trial. This wasn't a political group of people. Not a one of them, aside from me and my girlfriend at the time, had ever been involved in any political stuff at all. People had done fruit picking, and people who were just kind of passing through, kind of hanging out on the beach, suddenly found themselves immersed in the ins and outs of the legal system, the legislative system, the judicial system. We were deep involved in this. But now it was time to go. The jury said we weren't guilty. Let's get on the road. So there was a big fight among us. Some people were saying, come on, let's just take the deal. None of us intend to stay here and sit in anyway. And others were saying, no, it's the principle. If they want to drop charges, they can drop them. How dare they offer us a deal? And we went back and forth about it. We finally had a meeting. Well, we didn't call them meetings. We were very good at meetings. So instead we called it spaghetti dinner, which is where you end up doing the same thing, right? You talk about what's on the table. And after the spaghetti was gone, the only thing left on the table was the matter before us. So we started talking about how do we deal with them offering us a deal. And as I said, there were two sides. The ones who wanted to be political and force them through this trial, and the others who just wanted to be practical and get on the road. So eventually, what we did was, the question arose, what's the problem? The problem is that they're offering us a deal. The problem is not actually the deal, because as people pointed out, we're all leaving town. It's not that we want to sit in, but that they're offering us a deal and they have no right to. So I asked the question of the group, well, suppose we offered them a deal. Would that be okay? Everybody agreed that would be okay because we were in the right, they were in the wrong. We could offer them a deal. And actually, since the deal itself that they were offering us, there was nothing wrong with it, really, the conditions. It's just that they were offering it. So why don't we offer them essentially the same deal? For one thing, they have to accept it. It's the same deal they offered. But let us word it. Let us present it. And so we ended up in court suggesting, well, we read our statement in court, and what we said was that the county created this situation on December 20th, and if they created a similar situation, we would respond similarly. So it was not a promise not to sit in. In fact, it was a promise to sit in again if they force us into that before we get out of town. However, we said we didn't think that it was necessary to go through a jury trial to determine the right and wrong in this case. We think the people of Santa Cruz can determine right and wrong for themselves, looking at the facts. And so, it's a charge of trespassing in the county building. So we said, if in the end the county wants to forgive us our trespasses, we will forgive those who have trespassed against us.
Yay. Was there a loosening of police harassment against people in vehicles? I know you've been largely driven out of town in the throughout 1997. And I know in 1978, the next year, well, actually the next season after your trial where you successfully won, the city council passed the infamous sleeping ban, the city's anti-homeless ordinance. What happened to, was there a period of where they actually laid off homeless people there? Or?
Yeah, well, certainly off of us, you know, and but I think other people too. There was, among the things that Rager and I did was we launched countersuits ourselves. We went up to federal court, tried to get the feds to stop the county and the city from issuing these citations. I mean, we were sleeping in our vehicles in the city awaiting trial. I mean, truth was, a number of people wanted to leave town, but we couldn't. We had court dates now. So, you know, I was sitting up late in my van writing papers that I then would bring to Ray, and we'd go through it and, you know, legal things. And at first, there were a couple of times that policemen came to the door and knocked on the door, they stopped doing that. I mean, it was pretty clear that I was there. I'd see them cruise by. I'd see them see my light on, but they didn't bother us.
Did you actually get a court decision on that, or was it just
no.
a new policy?
No, it was everything was going by police policy up until then.
Did the City Council of Santa Cruz have much sympathy for anything, or I guess you went to the Board of Supervisors, but did you have any... We're trying to understand why this current City Council, I know you're not...
you know, deeply involved in the Camp Paradise matter, but Camp Paradise faces, in a way, a similar situation where they have no—they've got no legal place to go. They've been, you were kind of driven out of town. They, you know, they in essence have taken people from the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, who, where there's no room for them, and actually they've been sent to Camp Paradise, and they've been, you know, struggling. They've offered the city to move to a legal piece of property somewhere. They offered to pay for it because they're working people. They have a bicycle shop on the camp premises. I guess I'm wondering how the city council was, and I guess you don't have too much information on the council.
At that time, the city council was a very, very conservative city council.
Bert Muehle, a conservative? Spare me.
No, well, the Bert Muehle was not in the majority. Yeah, it was Bert Muehle, and before the whole thing was over, Mike Rodkin, but there was Gio and the conservatives.
Actually, Muehle voted for the sleeping ban himself, as did Rodkin, so...
That's right. Well, the progressives have not always been as progressive on homeless issues as they have been in other matters.
That's for sure. What about the attorney? That's what we were really... I was one of the reasons I initially called you. You had a group situation where the attorney actually related to the entire group, answered their questions, and didn't attempt to separate one person, walk off with him and privately talk to him, and then everybody was supposed to accept that as some kind of, dictate from on high.
No, in fact, we had an interesting situation in the Scott Creek trial. Our jury strategy was a very clever one. We were going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help us God. Which actually, I have to say, kind of blew them away because, you know, the truth often involved admitting things that we weren't even charged with. You know, really, people got on the stand and said all kinds of stuff that was not in keeping with presenting our best case. And after the police side of the question, the police got on the stand and answered questions and presented their whole case against us, whether we were trespassing, we were violating the camping laws. And when they rested their case, there was one glaring exception. One of the people, there was no testimony connecting this one particular person with any of the vehicles. So her thing was going to be dismissed. I mean, that was clear. We wouldn't even have to present a defense. And so what we did with the collaboration of our attorney was knowingly put her on the stand first. And our attorney asked his client, we were all his clients, I mean, there was no separation. And he asked her, were you living in one of those vehicles? And she said, yes, I was. He said, which one? And she described it. That was the first testimony the court had that connected her with any of the vehicles. Her case was about to be dismissed until she put into evidence, with the collaboration of her attorney, evidence against herself, like the rest of us were offering.
That sounds like a decision that was made at the Camp Paradise today when people who were visiting the camp, we were kind of role-playing what to do when the police arrived, and we decided, at least a number of us decided, if we were asked, do we live here? You know, is this your tent? We would all say yes at the same time. We would say, yes, it is our tent. And in essence, even though we don't live there, you know, even though we maybe lived there for one night, of course, we too would be technically guilty of violating the camping ban as a group.
Well, I have to say, Robert, that there is a central difference. It was essential to us that everything that we said in the courtroom was the truth. I mean, the whole truth and nothing, but it wasn't just a political move. It was also done because it was true. She got on the stand and said, I lived in that vehicle. I'm spending tonight in that vehicle. And the judge stopped the trial, sent the jury out of the room, took her into chambers, and advised her to get her own attorney, that this attorney was selling her out to the group, that her case would have been dismissed if not for this attorney. She said, no, I mean, he's talking to a woman who's called herself Rainbow Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And Rainbow Eyes said, no, we like Ray, we're going with Ray, and we're just here to tell the truth. And she stayed with us and within the group. And
she was found not guilty.
Of course.
I think Bob has a question. I don't think you can hear him. I've got your radio on, but I'll pass it on to you.
Yeah, essentially, there's a lot of people down here that are doing the same thing. We're acting as eyes and recording everything. We're recording everything on film. We're recording it in pictures. Believe me, in case the city council doesn't know, we're watching. I live in the house, but that doesn't matter. You know, I'm down there because I feel that these people are doing what they can for themselves, you know. And I'm going to sit down there and I'm going to record what's going on, you know. I've been taking pictures like crazy, you know. Everybody down there is recording this. This is not something that people can sit and lie about and say it's this and it's that, because we got the proof on film, you know, that of what's really going on down there, you know. Basically, what people need to do is go and look and decide for themselves, you know, whether this is a bad thing or whether this is a good thing, you know. If there's nothing bad going on, you got no reason to hide anything.
Tom, you haven't been down to Camp Paradise, but I would encourage you to come on down. It's open 24 hours a day, although it's best to come between the hours of, I guess, I don't know, 8 in the morning and 10 at night, you know, that are actually people are up till 1, but, and, you know, you can always bring some bubbles with you, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, of course, little think of the publicity. You get exposure.
Oh, that's what I need.
Hey, Channel 8's been down there twice.
So, is there a deadline right now, or the police anticipated?
They gave us a deadline. They gave, I should say, the Camp Paradise people a deadline, though I was down there last night, until today when they were going to ticket and tomorrow when they were going to arrest, but the word from Tim Fitzmaurice, who gave the word to Larry Templeton today, was that there is now no longer a deadline. So there's, it's not clear what the situation is. It seems to me that, you know, it and Lee is saying, one of our people in the studio, that they're, this is a form of confusion for folks. I think they're confused too, frankly, and they don't know what they're doing either. But but it does break down organized support when people don't know what's happening. So we're encouraging people to continue to be supportive, and I would encourage you to come on down. I know that on another subject, I'd like to get your thoughts on this. You've gotten a little play in the Santa Cruz Metro around the marimba menace on the mall and the issue of whether Sergeant Baker's ticketing or threatened ticketing of marimba players comports with the street performers' guidelines, which you and others were able to use to fend off a repressive set of laws by city council in the early 80s.
Yeah, 1980. That's right. At that time, there was, as I said, a very conservative city council, and they had a proposal to ban street performing in Santa Cruz. And the street performers of the time got together, and 35 street performers came to consensus on an alternative to a ban, which was to write down the unwritten rules of street performing and come to agreement with the residents downtown and the people who work in the shops, whether they own them or not, and with the police and with the city council and with the Downtown Neighbors Association, which with the Downtown Association. All of these groups endorsed the voluntary guidelines approach rather than the law. The truth is, you know, you can't replace the laws. There are still laws in effect. But you don't have to address every single situation as though it's an offense of the law. And so we asked them to, using the guidelines, address it. And the hospitality people downtown and the police, for the most part, since for the last 21 years, and the performers and the residents and the people working in the shops, have all used the voluntary guidelines approach. Now and again, something else comes up. And truth is, if the voluntary agreement among neighbors breaks down, then yeah, there are laws. In this case, as you say, Officer Baker went over.
Sergeant Baker
mm-hmm. went over to the a marimba band that was set up, and asked them to stop playing, or told them to stop playing, and they asked. They, I have to say, were unaware of the voluntary guidelines for the most part, though, although there was one member of the group at least who brought them up in the discussion. But most of the group, even afterwards, didn't know about that. So
they hadn't been playing for very long, as I understand.
No, about 3 songs.
Mm-hmm.
And the guidelines do call for people to get an hour before they have to rotate to another place or stop.
By the way, I haven't seen these guidelines either used by the hosts or the police much in the last few years. Instead, the police sort of arbitrarily tell certain people they can play and others they can't. We have Lee here in the studio, who's on the streets a lot. And Lee, what have you seen on this issue?
I think it's relatively arbitrary. I don't see that they're doing any obvious artistic policing, so to speak. It's more personality-oriented. a store recently moved to another location on the mall, and immediately one of the local musicians, who happened to be better known and not noise by any measure or artistic standards, was told he couldn't play out there away from the store anymore because it echoed into the building, even though he was legal distance away from the building, et cetera, et cetera. So there is an attempt to somehow control music on the mall. I'm not sure for what purpose. I haven't seen anybody thrown in jail over it.
And also there's been attacks on music at Lulu Carpenter's and the Catalyst and other places, largely under the direction, as I understand it, and I could be, this is what I've heard, and this is secondhand, of Lieutenant Patty Saponi, who seems to have the full permission and blank check of the police department to impose her own standards of music on the community.
Well, you know, I have to say, Robert, I attended a meeting this past week of the residents of the El Centro Hotel, the senior subsidized housing there.
Right, and they're concerned about the noise?
Yeah, they're concerned about all kinds of noise. I have to say, street performing is not their topmost issue, but there have been, the night before that meeting, there was some guy playing a guitar at 1:30 in the morning.
Oh, boy.
And you know, you should see their faces when they describe any particular incident that woke them up and kept them up for an hour and a half with it, you know.
And that's not legal under most guidelines.
So the meeting that I attended was El Centro residents together with Palomar residents,
right,
together with some people from the St. George. And so they're getting together and trying to put pressure on the police to go out and enforce the various noise ordinances, the motorcycles going by, the guys laying down patches of rubber, the people pouring out of the Catalyst at the end of the thing, or the people from the Dakota, the various spots, and the people in the coffee roast, the late night, you know, partying that's going on downtown while the people are trying to sleep. So they're applying pressure from one side.
But the marimba players were not there at that particular time, nor were they near any kind of residence. They were at least a block away from anything. So
they were in front of O'Neill's.
It's important to distinguish here, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. That's why... When you say there, when you want to pull in these other questions about the Lulu Carpenters or Wired Wash or some of these other scenes, I'm not sure how closely they are related. There's certainly pressure coming for them to respond, but the marimba thing has got me baffled. Like, marimbas are loud. I'll say that. There are some other performers who are concerned about how long is that marimba thing going to go on, so that I can play anywhere near that spot. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there are things. I mean, personally, it's such a happy music, and there are so many of them, and they're so infrequently there, that I think there's plenty of room for it to happen downtown. And if everybody, you know, kind of re-ups on what the guidelines approach to it is, which is more important than even, you know, any particular guideline. Is it a 1 hour? We don't have to even treat them like they're laws. The point of the guidelines is to get us to treat each other like neighbors. You know, if the guy that lives next door to me hates to hear my Patsy Cline music playing when I open my door during the day, he can tell me that, you know, shut that damn... And I can tell him, go to hell, wait till 10 o'clock at night. There's a curfew on noise, you know. Until then, you can't do it. That's laws. That's the only thing I can do to get the law. But we're neighbors. We don't have to do that. He can tell me, look, I work nights. Her voice, that whining, it drives me nuts. And I can say, yeah, what about those garbage barrels you put out there and that freeform jazz you play? We can make any kind of agreement. So if the performers and the merchants and the residents and the people working in the shops are neighbors, we can come to agreements about whether Cosmic Chris can play in front of Pacific Trading when the doors are open, or whether he should move over to here. Because, you know, if they apply the laws, I mean, if this one doesn't work, there's going to be another one, man. You know, if we're just all going to get exactly our rights, the street performers are not going to win, you know.
We're talking to street performer. Well, you haven't been on the streets for a while.
Yeah,
but
a long time.
But you haven't forgotten your roots, sounds like. Tom Noddy, and also in the studio with us, Bob Lee and your very own Uncle Robert on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Tom, are you... is anyone actually, I guess the street performers guidelines are sitting in the host's HQ, the little...
Yeah, they hand them out as well. I've talked to a number of performers up and down the mall, handing them copies lately. I'm back in town for a little stretch, and so I've been walking the streets and handing them back out like I used to in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
When they started the host program for the performers, that was... the truth is, when we formed the Santa Cruz Street Performers Guild,
mm-hmm,
our purpose in being as a guild was to make the guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
To get through this effort to ban it and put the paper out there, because we're not going to continue to exist as an organization and we're not going to enforce these things. What we just wanted to do was put our peer pressure on paper and pass it on to the future. And that's worked for 21 years, partly because the hosts are out there handing them out to the new guys who come into town. When they don't, and when they fill in the blanks, which sometimes happens, if they don't read them carefully, if they've forgotten, you know, it's a new generation of them. If they don't know why they got a one-hour rotation before they're moved along, or why, in fact, the person in the shop needs to talk to them as a neighbor rather than here's the law that means you have to move. It's not a law. That's the reason we have guidelines.
Instead of guidelines, yeah.
Because the laws are too rigid.
Well, the hosts are, in essence, a private security force for the merchants. That's been my impression of their behavior for the last 7 years. So I'm not, insofar as the guidelines can be used to restrict, control, and move along street musicians, I think that's the point. I've not seen the hosts actually using the guidelines to go to merchants and say, look, why don't you guys work this out? I think that maybe that does happen, but I haven't seen much of it. Ken, are you accessible to people who are having problems with music? Do you wish to be in any way? Are you part of a mediation effort, or should we refer everybody to Christopher Crone, who council member who I believe is has not been meeting his obligations in numerous fields, but at least in this matter, at least recently, seems to be. He went out and spoke to the musicians after the last city council meeting. He's quoted in the cities, in the metro. We could always refer people to Crone. Are you at all involved in this? Do you want to have your number put out in any way? Are you?
You know, I think it would be a mistake. Early on, as this thing, right after the marimba thing came down, I leaped in with both feet. I think it's a good idea because I was afraid that people, a number of people went to the city council. Their first thought was to try and get a street performer law put in. My experience with this matter suggests that a law will work against us. It'll be amended. Even if we get a good law, if we had a perfect city council and they gave us exactly and only what the street performers wanted, city councils come and go, the merchants come and go. I've talked to them recently and said, you know, I mean, I've been here since 1980 trying to re-up these guidelines, and it's worked.
Well, I think the problem has not been with we're looking for a new law, but that the police department don't seem to be following the old laws, which have to do with...
Well, actually, if they follow the old laws to the letter...
Well, 10 o'clock was when noise becomes a serious matter.
That's noise, but I don't want to quote too much. Yeah. But there are a number of laws that could be applied that are not being applied to street performers. And if they were, things wouldn't work as well as they do for some people who are out there making coin right now.
Sure. Been applied selectively by police and no doubt will be again. I mean, the question is, what is the policy in the police department?
Yeah, and so the policy in the police department, in the best of times, and we might be heading back toward one of the better times, is to respect the guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, I'm out of town, I don't remind people. There were a number of performers in town who didn't remember the guidelines. There were a number of host people who knew that they had these copies of the guidelines that didn't get what the point was. There were a number of police who just think the there's laws and that's it. They don't know about the guidelines.
Is there someone people can call, Tom? I'm trying to wind this,
yeah,
this down a bit.
I don't think calling Christopher Crone is such a bad idea. Yeah, they could go through him. The problem is that I go out of town. I'm about to leave again on Saturday for the Oregon Country Fair. Then I come back, and then I leave town. If I get too central to this thing, then I'm not there when crunch time comes and the whole thing falls.
Well,
so I need not to be a pillar.
Sure. I guess people can get copies of the guidelines at the Downtown Information Center. As I like to call them, the host center next to the Delmar, what was the Delmar Theater.
That's right. They have copies of the guidelines. And the guidelines, as you point out, the hosts have them. And they say right in the beginning to the performer, dear performer, these might have been handed to you by one of them, but they are produced by us. They come, the guidelines that they have are what we, 35 street performers, came to consensus on.
Mm-hmm.
They're not something produced by the city, not something produced by the host. They are the agreement that the street performers themselves put forward and got passed by a number of different city councils.
None of whom are still living around the streets, but nonetheless.
Well, there are actually the odd guy here and there, and I'm one of them.
Well,
yeah, I qualify.
Well, look, Tom, I appreciate your giving us both your perspective on the Scott Creek Bluff, you know, the historical perspective and how that attorney worked, and you know, I know you were also involved in 1996, as was I,
in stopping a repressive ordinance against drumming.
Yeah.
That was quite a turnaround when I think we were able, to, in the middle of a council meeting, to convince Kennedy to turn tail on the Rodkin repression law. And
the Chronicle referred to it as a marvel of grassroots organizing.
Yeah, and I think that when I went to the council Tuesday before last, I was denounced by some of the musician who remembered the 1996 and somehow blamed me as being the bad guy, but I think that there were a number of good guys, and I was one, and you were one, and Kennedy, in spite of himself, was one. So I'm glad when that happens.
You've always amused me, Robert.
Well, thank you, Tom. anything you want to say for our Free Radio fans, and when's your next bubble show? I mean, at Camp Paradise, when are you doing your bubble show?
No, I'm not really sure how that's going to work out. I am putting things together for this trip that I'm about to take. I would love to get a chance to swing by there, though I encourage people who can to get out there and get a look at it so that they know what they're going to be reading about in the newspaper from their own eye.
Definitely. Well, thanks, Tom, and hey, call in again, and if you can, blow a bubble for us.
Okay, buddy.
Bye-bye.
See you, bye.
And this is still Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your inimitable host, Uncle Robert. And, hey, our phone lines are open, 427, a little too loud on that, 427-3772.
Sitting on downtown sidewalks, using profane language, panhandling while drunk, or lying about how the...